This evening, as I mentioned, I just come back from a grueling trip to Sydney, so I'm a bit tired this evening, but I often tell people I feel that I'm a talk machine. You put me in front of a microphone, wind me up, and out comes the talk. And sometimes the ones which aren't prepared or the ones where you're tired, sometimes they get the best. We'll just see what happens today. But I did pick up an email from somebody who asked about an old question in Buddhism. Is Buddhists always seem to be so passive, and so passive, in fact, that they don't really do very much for themselves and for the world. Sometimes that they don't even stand up for themselves. And is that really what Buddhism is supposed to be doing? If you're a meditator, does that mean that you just let other people abuse you, exploit you, and just give you a hard time? And of course the answer is no. The Buddhism is not just a passive religion where you do nothing. It is when you meditate. That's when you just sit here and just let things be and relax and be able to let go of the struggle of life and the fight of life. But when we meditate, we just can relax. And it's very important to find those times when we can be peaceful, because when we do let go of the struggle of life, it means that we can rest, regenerate our energies, and also get some insight and wisdom into how to best deal with these problems which come up in life. It's a great strategy, not for escaping from life, but more for energizing, empowering yourself so you can face life with greater wisdom, with greater energy, with greater kindness, with greater success. But it doesn't mean that people meditate all the time. And of course, you know myself, I don't hide what I do. I'm not sitting meditation all the time. There are times I work very hard. There are times, when I'm sitting meditation at the airport, I don't just sit there and just let go when they start calling my name to get on the aircraft. I don't say, I'm not attached, I'm not attached, I'm not attached. You know, you actually do something when it's time to do something. So there is an active part of Buddhism, and part of that active part of Buddhism is actually looking after yourself and looking after others, standing up for yourself. There is a classic story, which isn't in Opening the Door of Your Heart, but I haven't told it for a long time here. And it's a story, and I love stories again, simply because that I can say these things in a few words, but if you say it in a story, people actually remember it. And that's the story of the bad snake. And it's based on a Jataka tale from the time of the Buddha. But what we usually do these days, we take these old stories and we jazz them up, add a little bit here, add a little bit there to make it sort of appropriate for our modern age and also give it a bit of an extra. So the story of the bad snake was this. Once upon a time, there was a really bad snake. He was mean and vicious and malicious, a really bad character. Now, this snake, now most snakes, you leave them alone and they won't harm you. I remember on that one occasion, this is another little story again, I just always go off on tangents because tangents are really interesting. That was that one time when I'd been meditating all night and I was very tired. Like, I feel a bit tired now. When you're tired, your mindfulness isn't as good as it usually is. So I've been meditating all night in this monastery over in Thailand. And, in the early morning, just of course you went out to go to toilet. But in those jungles, just going out to, the ordinary toilet, you just go out into the forest. Squat down, as you've seen Asians squat down, and then you just urinate in the bush. So it was just the first light of day, so I wasn't seeing very clearly. My mindfulness wasn't strong. So when I squatted down and started urinating, I really did think I was urinating on a stick. And then that stick started to move. I know what it's like. You're a bit tired. You don't get scared. You think, oh, that's a snake. It's like you're really stupid. But of course, afterwards I was a bit afraid because I thought, my goodness. Because when you squat down, you're not standing, you're squatting, remember? And that was a very venomous snake. And as I tell people these days, the most sensitive part of a male's body was only a few inches away from that venomous snake. And yeah, you girls won't appreciate this, but men, sometimes it makes you squirm. Oh, no. But of course, it did not bite me. And to this day, I always think that I know now why it didn't bite me. Because this was in a Buddhist monastery, in a Buddhist country, Thailand. And I'm really sure to this day that that snake never bit me as I peed on it, because it thought it was being blessed with holy water. We do holy water in Buddhism as well. I mean, you can't get more holy than that. I mean, straight from the source. And it's warm as well, not those other holy water we have over in our temples, which is sometimes cold. You sprinkle it on people and they sort of jump. So it was a time I blessed a snake with holy water from the source, peed on it. And it just went its way and I went my way, no problem at all. So now most snakes you see, you know, over in, even in Serpentine, you know, a few snakes you see there every now and again, maybe once a year you see a snake. They're okay. You know, if you go to our meditation center or you go to the nuns' monastery or our monastery, you don't have to worry about those snakes, because all those snakes are Buddhist snakes. So you're safe. But every now and again you get, like, just like human beings, you get snakes, you know, with attitude. You know, bad snakes. And this was this really bad snake. You know, if anyone peed on this bad snake, they would bite them everywhere, not just in one place. And so this was a very bad snake. He would bite people even though they weren't sort of threatening him. He would actually follow them and bite them, you know, just for fun. As I said, it's, you know, the snake's fun, not the person's fun. So this was a very bad and dangerous snake. He'd hurt and killed many people. And of course, once you get a bad snake like that, or a bad animal, people know that where the snake lives, and they just do a big detour around it. They don't even go close. It's a dangerous area. The word gets around. So people would leave that snake alone. And so the snake was living there, really sort of a tough guy snake. You know, if there was bikies in the snake kingdom, he would have joined them. He'd have had tattoos if he could find a parlor which would do tats for him. But he was a very mean and bad snake. But as what happens, you know, when you live your life, you maybe some of you have done some mean and bad things in your life, but as you start to get older, you know, you start to think about life and about the meaning of life, and especially, you know, what happens to you when you die. Even snakes think like that as well. What happens to snakes, you know, when they die? Do snakes go up to heaven? Do you want to go meet snakes when you go up to heaven? Or do snakes go to hell? Or do they get reincarnated? So the snake, you know, he started to think about what happens to snakes after they die. You know, in a word, to make it brief, the snake got religious. And of course, you know, when people want to ask those questions, they'll go to the, you know, the experts, you know, the monks, the priests. We're supposed to know about these things. But, you know, all his life, that snake was always bad-mouthing, you know, these monks, no good, as bald-headed idiots. They should get a proper job instead of people feeding them and bowing down to them. Just what do they think they are? You know, and so he was always saying bad things about the monks and the priests and the nuns, everybody. He was a very bad-mouthed snake. But then he thought, well, you know, never. A lot of people have a lot of faith in these guys and these girls. Maybe, just maybe, they may know something. So he decided to go and see one of these holy men, but not a man, because he couldn't understand men. There was even a holy snake, not far away from where the snake lived. On top of the mountain lived a holy snake. And all his mates, the other snakes, said, oh, you should go up to see this snake. It's a really wise snake. So one day he decided to go. But you know what it's like, you know, when you first go to a temple. Most people, when they first go to the temple, usually sit by the doors, or even better, outside, because if they don't like it, they can sneak out very quickly. And that's what he did. But actually, before he came in, he decided to go in disguise, because, you know, he was embarrassed if his friends would recognize him. So he put on a pair of dark glasses, put on one of his fedora hats and a raincoat, and the snake slithered up to the mountain in disguise, to see this holy snake. And there, just like in the humans, the snake, the holy snake, was sitting on a rock and giving a sermon, you know, with a microphone and on the internet, you know, to giving this sermon to all these little snakes who were sitting down there and listening to him. And the bad snake sat at the entrance. But what happened, you know, as the bad snake started to listen a bit more, you know, it actually made sense. And even the bad snake told a few jokes every now and again, which he thought was very funny. And he never realized, a bad snake never realized that holy snakes told jokes every now and again. But there it was. And so, it wasn't just entertainment. What that holy snake said started to make sense. So much so that by the end of the sermon, the bad snake was converted. He took off his glasses, he took off his hat and coat, and everyone recognized him. My good, look who's come to the temple. The bad snake has come to the temple. He came right up to the front after question time and said to the holy snake, I've lived a terrible life. I've done such bad things to so many people, and I feel so sorry. I shouldn't have done that. I don't want to go to the hell. I want to have a nice rebirth. And the holy snake taught him about forgiveness, to let go of the past. We all make mistakes. One of the nicest things about spirituality, we can forgive almost anything. Actually, we do forgive everything. And the holy snake was just the bad snake was so taken by the holy snake's compassion. He said, right, you're my teacher, you're my master, what should I do? And that's when the holy snake gave the bad snake the 5 Buddhist precepts. He made him a Buddhist. From now on, he said, you must not intentionally kill any living being. That includes biting your enemies. Not to steal, not to commit adultery, not to go along with the wives of other snakes, not to lie, and not to go to the pub where the snakes go on a Saturday night. Not to drink alcohol. Keep the 5 precepts. And the snake, because when you first come and you really get converted, you know, that's the time you're the most religious. He went up there and he took the 5 precepts in a loud voice. And he said, I'm a changed snake. I'm a good snake. I'll live a good life. I'll go and help people. I'll join Amnesty International. I'll give donations to Greenpeace. I'll become a vegetarian. I'll do everything now. People make all these promises at first. It usually lasts a few days, and they go back to normal again afterwards. And as he left, the bad snake gave a donation in the box as well. He gave coins. You know why people put coins in the donation box? Because everyone can hear it. See, I'm giving donation. He was just showing off. So anyway, he went back to his place by the side of the road. Now he was a good snake. But of course, the people didn't know that. He couldn't put a sign up saying, I don't bite anymore. Because, you know, he can't write in English. So if he did write a sign, it would be s-s-s-s-s-s. He wouldn't be able to know. So people would still avoid him. They'd still put this big detour, even though it was a long way out of the way, because they still thought he was a dangerous snake. Even though he actually did have one of these Amnesty International badges on his chest. And even though sometimes they did actually see him sitting cross-coiled by his hole in meditation. Because he's a good snake now. But they didn't know that he was a good snake. But once a kid was just, you know, had this iPod on. Actually, they told me yesterday at the airport that they were paging for this kid at the airport. Would Mr. Jones, come, we're waiting for you. The whole plane is waiting for you. And then this Mr. Jones, this kid of maybe about 18, he rocked up and he had his iPod on. He hadn't heard any announcements. He just walked in as if he was only aircraft. So very carefully, if you go to the airport, please don't put your iPod on with these headphones in. You won't be able to hear anything, and you keep everyone else waiting. But anyway, that's another story. But this guy, he was actually had the iPod on with his earphones, and he walked right past the bad snake. And as soon as he realized what he'd done, he was scared, but he realized the snake hadn't actually bit him. Just actually the snake watched him and just smiled religiously. And at that was the first time they realized that snake wasn't dangerous anymore. And soon that people would just walk right over that snake. They'd step over him. And the snake didn't mind because You know, he's a Buddhist knight now. He was just so compassionate and kind to people. But even amongst any community, there's not just some bad snakes, there's also bad humans as well. And there was a, you know, little gang of kids, you know, really bad scallywag kids. And these kids decided one afternoon to tease that bad snake. They came up to him and started verbally abusing him, first of all. What type of snake do you think you really are? You're not a real snake, you're just like an oversized worm. You probably haven't even got any fangs. Come on, show us your fangs if you've got any one. You're a disgrace to your species. You're just a slimy creep. Which is actually quite true, because all snakes are creeps. They're a bit slimy too. But, you know, even though that some of those words were true, and even though you've done nothing wrong, when you're scolded, what does it feel like? You know, when you're called names and you're accused of things you didn't do, that really hurts you. And that snake, he was a proud snake. He said, "What are you doing this to me for?" he was thinking. And he said, "Well, I can't defend myself because I can't bite anybody anymore." So that snake, the Buddhist snake, just had to take it. And when they realized the snake was not reacting at all, you know, like what some people do? They take advantage of you. So the kids started picking up stones and like little clods of earth and throwing at the snake. And some of those stones hit and they hurt, they bruised that snake. And the snake was boiling inside, thinking, "Hey, you know, why can't I just bite one of these kids? Just one, that's all. And I'll show them I've got fangs. I'll show them what I really am. But these five blubbing precepts, I can't do anything." And that encouraged the kids even more. They came up to him with the sticks and started beating him over the back. And this poor snake, because he had the five precepts, because he was now a Buddhist, he couldn't do anything at all. He just took the beating. And he realized, maybe in a monastery, maybe when you're staying in the temple you can keep five precepts, but out there in the world, in business, you know, in the family, whatever, it's a tough world out there, isn't it? Maybe in the monasteries you can keep these five precepts, but they're impractical. Impractical, it can't be done. So after his beating, he decided to crawl painfully up to that holy snake to get released from his vows of non-violence and five precepts. And when the holy snake saw him coming, all bruised and bloody, the holy snake shouted out at him, "What's happened to you? You look terrible." And the bad snake, "It's your fault, you fake of a snake. Give me those stupid five precepts. You know, you can't sort of keep five precepts in this world. You should get real, holy snake. Get out there in the world. Do what we have to do. Get a job. Go out there like we all have to do. Instead of staying in your temple meditating, then you'll find out you can't keep these precepts." And the holy snake listened and said, "You stupid snake. You idiot snake. You hopeless snakes," said the holy snake to the bad snake. And the bad snake was quite taken aback. "What do you mean I'm a bad snake, a stupid snake? I did what you told me. I kept the five precepts, non-violent, joined Greenpeace." And the holy snake said, "Yes," he said, "I told you to keep the five precepts. I told you not to kill people. I told you not to bite people. But I never told you not to hiss. And that's all you needed to do, snake, hiss. So go back to where you live. And when those kids came back next time, just hiss at them and they will run a mile." And that was the story of the bad snake. And how in life you can still keep the five precepts. You can still be non-violent. But you must always remember to hiss every now and again. And that's what we mean by being assertive. Not aggressive, but assertive. Hissing is all you really need to do. And that's actually being a monk, you do live in the real world. Sometimes I live more in the real world than you guys do. You know, because the real world always comes to me and just asks me questions and rings me up and sends me emails and does all this other stuff. And you always have to go talking to people and helping people and funeral services, marriage services, baby services, ghostbusting services. Wow, it's cradle to beyond the grave service, which we do. We get into some really interesting things as a monk, which you have to get to do. I mentioned this in Sydney last night, that some of the stuff which I have to do, which is really interesting. I told Dennis yesterday, I'm not sure if I said this last week, but you may have remembered me telling you that I go and do conferences as well, conferences about everything, even conferences about IT. Computing, like I'm a monk, I'm a low-tech monk, but I gave the keynote address at the 2010 World Computer Conference in Brisbane last September. And when they invited me, I thought, oh, this is really cool, I've never done this before, I know nothing about computers, so let's give it a try. And I got the email last week from the organizer. Actually, is he here? I think he's coming this weekend. I don't know if he's here. Johan, are you here? No, maybe he didn't make it. Maybe he's coming tomorrow. But he told me that, you know, being a big IT conference, ITC conference, they call it these days, that they put all the talks on the internet, on their website. And he said, your talk, Ajahn Brahm, was by far the most downloaded. That you were the expert. You were the success. You were the star of the show. And it's amazing, isn't it? There you can actually know nothing about computers and outwit all these professors. And of course, I've done the same on that when I went over to 6PR one evening. Just after Friday night, one of our members here was a producer some years ago, and 6PR was one of our local radio stations. And he says, why didn't you go on one of these talkback shows? Because, you know, you answer questions, you know, you can tell jokes. I'm sure you do really well on a talkback show. So I said, yeah, but you know, where can I do that? And I thought, after the Friday night talk here. So one evening, I finished the talk here and just, you know, got to the studios in East Perth. And just, you know, you always line up to ask questions here. When I ask you, are there any questions, no one puts their hand up. But as soon as you're released, a big line of people asking questions again. You know, I know you guys. But anyway... You know, I was late getting to the studio, so I just got there in time, 10 o'clock, to get into the studio, put your headphones on just in front of the microphone, and we started the show immediately. And that's when the presenter introduced my co-host. And it was, I always remember this girl, Dr. Gabrielle Morrissey was the co-host. And they announced her, all these books she's written, a professor on sex. She was the expert in Australia. Sometimes I've seen, you know, her interviewed in the newspapers. She was, you know, West Australian, not sort of, you know, the gross newspapers. But she is the expert, the professor, the go-to person on intimate questions. And then they introduced me as well. And I thought, what is the show? And it was on adult themes. Not on Buddhism, not about meditation, but all the stuff which I gave up 36 years ago. But there you are, you're a monk in that situation. And I must admit, I do enjoy being in those situations. Way, way, way out of my comfort zone. And it was a lovely experience because, you know, people actually ring in their questions. And only after about 10 minutes... all the questions were coming to me. And at this particular time, you know, I tried to tell them my name, Ajahn Brahm, but they just couldn't get their tongue around it. So in the end, we came to this agreement. We'd call me Mr. Monk. That's what they did. It's a light show. So they're ringing up. I've got a question for Mr. Monk. I've got a question for Mr. Monk. Can I ask Mr. Monk this? And the expert, she was actually doing absolutely nothing, just sitting there getting bored. And I wonder why that was. Why is it that, you know, that comes to just a monk? So it's, why is it that a monk can give the most popular keynote at a computer conference? Or that other story, that we had a transport conference in the Duxton Hotel when Alada Mutina was a transport minister. I got to know her quite well. And had a, you know, the community conference on transport or something. And at lunchtime, they all went out for lunch, but you know, it was too late for me, so I was hanging around there. So a reporter came up to me and interviewed me. Because I was doing nothing, so yeah, I'll do an interview for you. And it was on shipping. That's another thing which I'm an expert on. You know my background, theoretical physics, and then becoming a monk. I was a teacher for a while, but he was interviewing me on, like, you know, the benefit of shipping as a main means of transport. And so I did this interview for him, and he came out to me about 6 months later, you know, just to tell me the results of that interview. He said, and I always remember this, he said that interview was syndicated to all the major shipping magazines and journals in our whole world, everywhere. Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York, you know, Buenos Aires. It went everywhere. You know, he gave it the quiche title of Zen and the Art of Shipping by Ajahn Brahm. But what happened next was he got all these emails from, you know, his other sort of journalists throughout the world and say, who is this Ajahn Brahm? Who is this? We don't know who he is, but he certainly knows what he's talking about. And that just cracked me up. Because, of course, I don't know what I'm talking about at all. But there you are. You can get this very popular article throughout the whole world. So it's interesting that you can actually get and do these sorts of stuff. You get away from your comfort zones, but you relax and you respond with kindness. And it's amazing what you can do. There's absolutely no limitations at all, it seems. Not for me, anyway. I have good fun. So anyway, so when people actually try to... I don't know where I came from, why I started this anyway, but I know in my life as a monk, I've always tried to stand up for causes which I really believed in. For those of you who've been coming here a long time, you know, one of the first things which we stood up for, we had these clay trucks coming past our monastery. It'd been a big business, was sending these trucks past our monastery. And it was not only noisy, but we actually saw one of those trucks turn over, you know, going down the steep hill from Bodhinyana Monastery, Kingsbury Drive. It's a very steep hill and very windy. And it turned over. And the only way it could stop itself, I know it's turned over because it lost control of the vehicle, and it actually turned into the bank to turn itself over so the friction of the trays scraping across the road could stop it. Otherwise, it had gone across the Southwest Highway and didn't know who it might have killed. So it was a very brave driver to do that, but I realized this is dangerous and I should actually stand up for the people who come into the monastery and also for the monks in that monastery as well. It was very dangerous. So we fought that for 3 or 4 years, I think. I don't know how long we fought that, but I decided that this was wrong, that it was dangerous, and had to stand up for it. So I did a lot of hissing at that time, but we weren't aggressive. And I remember it was Christmas, just before Christmas, and the monk who was helping me, almost like my secretary at that time, was Ajahn Sujato. I just was with him in Santi Monastery in New South Wales this morning and yesterday and the day before. And I remember it came to Christmas time, or just before Christmas, and he got these Christmas cards and it wrote it out to all the people we were fighting. You know, to the people working in the brick company and other people who were fighting us. And he said, Merry Christmas to you all. We wish you all happiness and well-being. And I thought it was a beautiful thing to do. Even though that there was, you know, a fight going on between us and the adversaries of sending these trucks down, we always managed to fight with kindness and never with anger. So if you are going to stand up for something, please, please, please never do so with anger. Assertiveness, yes. But assertiveness always has a kindness as well. Because you're not just standing up for yourself. And I think this is one thing we should always remember, especially in Buddhism. Because if you stand up for yourself, there's something inside you thinks this is wrong. You shouldn't do this. But then if you don't stand up for yourself, you know, you get sort of steamrolled and bullied, and it's really unfair, and there's something wrong with that too. And the answer is something I've said many, many times here. You don't stand up for yourself. You don't give in to the other person. You stand up for us. So it's actually not fighting the trucks. It was actually standing up for us, for everybody. The drivers of those trucks who could easily kill themselves, the brick company, which might get into big trouble if they sort of, if they kill somebody. You guys who were coming up and down our monastery feeding us, the monks, everybody. We're standing up for everybody. So when you do make a stand, it's not just for you. It is for us. And that makes it far more ethical and moral. It may be somebody in your life, maybe in your office, who's abusing you. And this has happened so many times. They come up to me, there's a manager or a fellow worker, and they really are just causing a huge amount of problem for you. You know, just abusing you, telling things which you didn't do to your boss or whatever, or the boss is just abusing you. And what should you do? Should you just take it? Or should you just fight? And if you fight, it gets into big trouble. You have to go and see this person, that person. You may lose your job because they may blame you as being the troublemaker, but you're actually just standing up for a person. Should you be a whistleblower and get into trouble? What should you do? And a lot of times I've told people, you know, if you really think you can do something and change something, never think it's for you, but it's for us. If you've got a manager who's really, really abusing his position, then you're standing up, not just for yourself, but for all the other people he may abuse or she may abuse in the future. And you're also standing up for him too. He's doing something wrong, he needs to know that. So whenever there is a problem like that, you're standing up, you're not just a victim. It's not just about you, it's about the system, it's about the people, it's about all the other people who might be in that situation in the future. You're standing up for us. It's not my problem, it's not their problem. It is always our problem. So we are assertive. That bad snake is hissing at those kids to help the kids as well, not just to protect its own body. It's about us and the right relationships we have. So we make those stands. And if you do make those stands, yes, you will get some criticism, some flack from time to time. And I've got plenty of flack in my life. Still get flack for some of the causes I stood up for, but I sometimes really enjoy them. It was great for that clay truck business. Eventually we just wore them down, they just went somewhere else. And I remember one of the next things we stood up for, I stood up for the gay and lesbian community here in Perth. It was just a silly thing. I think it's holding the Dalai Lama. I think he was misquoted, but it got in the newspapers, the West Australian, our local newspaper, that he said, you can't be a Buddhist and homosexual, period. That's what was quoted. And you know, some of the people came up here, you know, there's many sort of gay and lesbian people in our Buddhist society, and they said, is this right? I said, of course it's not right. You know, Buddhism opens its doors to everybody. It says, the door of my heart is open to everybody. And the same as the Buddha, our Buddhist society. It doesn't matter who you are, everybody can come in and join. And you know, to me, that just was really wrong. So what did I do? Wrote a letter to the West Australian saying the Dalai Lama was wrong. I really got some flack for that one. But yeah, I got some comments back. People go, you can't criticize the Dalai Lama. Now, remember, you can criticize anybody. Please criticize, you know, the Pope, criticize me, criticize our President Dennis, criticize God if you like. Because this is important. Without criticizing, without feedback, you know, these people who sit up here every Friday evening, or even higher thrones like a pope or an archbishop, or if they don't get feedback, it's very easy for us to lose our way. So criticism is wonderful. So just because, I know this is important, especially in Sri Lanka or in Thailand, oh no, it's bad karma to criticize a monk. You look at the original teachings of the Buddha, and the lay people were criticizing the monks very regularly, and that's actually where we got all the rules of Vinaya from, because the monks had lost their way, they'd made a mistake, and they needed to get feedback. Wonderful. So there is no holy cow or holy monk or holy nun who's beyond criticism. Just because you're in that situation, you're the boss, the manager, the president or whatever, criticize, please. Otherwise, without presidents getting criticism or feedback, sometimes they lose the plot. And you know that. You've seen it many, many times. So it's okay to criticize. And so, but anyway, I did take some flack for standing up for the gay and lesbian community, but I also got a lot of privileges as well. And of course, one of the great privileges, I was very proud of this, and I look back upon this with joy. I was invited to the Gay and Lesbian Pride breakfast. And I thought that was a wonderful thing. And I really sort of, I counted that as an honor. I didn't actually get invited on one of the floats and the gay and lesbian Mardi Gras. That might be a bit interesting. But anyway, maybe next time. But I made a stand there. And why did I make a stand? Even though you know you're getting flat, because it was obviously it was right, you know, to actually make a stand. And for I know some of the gay and lesbian transgender people came up and said, thank goodness that one religion was being kind to us. Because I always remember just going to the old St. Anne's Hospital, Mercy Hospital, to give a talk. And this elderly guy came. He said, I'm one of the leaders of the gay lesbian community over here in Perth. And then what he said next, again, something I'll never forget, he looked at me and said, religion has been so cruel to us over the years. And he said that in a way which he realized it was coming from a huge amount of hurt. And, you know, you could just listen to that hurt and say, this is wrong, and I'm going to do something about that. And, you know, so now I'm in a position being sort of able to go on the internet and being able to sort of talk to people. That is not Buddhism, to criticize and be cruel to anybody. And so I know that sort of some other religions, they say, oh, well, you know, they love homosexuals, but they don't like the homosexual act. And I say, well, that's like saying, you know, we don't, well, Christians are okay, but just don't practice Christianity. Or like, it's okay being a supporter of the Dockers, but don't cheer for them. Don't go to a match. There's something really wrong there. And I stand up for that. I don't care if I get into trouble. And you shouldn't care if you get into trouble either, because if people don't stand up for what they know is right, what they really believe in, if they're not assertive, then our world is lost. And that's one of the great things about our democracy. We want our democracy because people are being assertive. Not violent, but assertive. So don't just let people sort of go over you. It's not again for you, it's for us also. I don't get anything out of standing up for people. I also stood up for the nuns' ordinations and got into trouble for that. I don't get anything out of that. Now, I wasn't gay when I was a lay person. I had my girlfriend, so I don't get anything out of this. I am not a nun, so you know, helping with the ordination runs, I don't get anything out of this. Except sort of trouble, but it's something you've got to stand up for, which is important. And so being assertive, I think, is an important part of our life. Standing up for what's right. And if you are being bullied, hiss. Now, how you hiss, you don't need to be aggressive, but you can be smart. One of the other parts of Buddhism, which is very strong, is our psychology. Now, we've been meditating and looking at our mind for 2,500 years. So we've got the goods on this mind. You know, we understand how this thing works. And so the psychology is very, very easy. You know, how if someone's bullying you, how to give them feedback. How you give them feedback, you've heard this before, but it comes into this talk, sandwich method, remember. Sandwich method. If you just say, don't do that, they realize, oh yeah, I'm getting at them, and they give you more back. You're reacting with negativity. So what you do with the sandwich method is someone is bullying you and they're giving you a hard time. So you go up to them and say something really nice to them. You know, you're just a wonderful boss. You know, I've seen just how hard you work in this office. And you're so good at your job. Just it's amazing just what you do for this company. Now you do that with honesty. Because you pick up the strong points, and then they're listening to you. And that is when you say, but you really treat me and the other people like dirt. Whatever else it is there. So you actually give it to them. You give the criticism. That's what we mean sandwich method. Now, the nice stuff, first of all, the praise, and then the criticism, and then you follow with praise. And you wouldn't believe, I think you may have tried this already because I've mentioned it before, but that is highly effective of communicating the message that you are, you know, what you're doing is unacceptable. But if you just say, your behavior is unacceptable, they just won't listen. The praise is there to open their mind because they realize that this person respects them and they're listening and opening and opening. Give me my next piece of praise, please. And that's when you put the message in. And then you're saying, but I still value you. So they're not your enemy. You realize that it is about us. We respect you. But this is one little thing about you which, you know, is causing problems. And that way, they listen. So you're being assertive, but you're not being foolish. And your message is very likely to get in. You are practicing your compassion. And the whole thing is surrounded by compassion. But in it is the right feedback, the right criticism. A lot of times the reason why people don't get assertive is because you tried before and it just doesn't work. You get criticized back. The whole thing goes pear-shaped. A whole big, you know, a small problem in the office turns into this big problem and you've got to go to conciliation and with the HR manager and it goes all crazy. You can't sleep at night and lawyers get involved and you lose your house. Ah, where did this all start from? It's because you didn't do it right. So it needs to be done, but if it's done in a proper way, it's amazing just how powerful that can be. And so you can be assertive, and you can give feedback, and you can stand up for yourself in a very, very wise, and for other people in a very beautiful and wise way. And we are assertive. And that's one of the things I love to see growing here in Australia. As Buddhism gets stronger and stronger, we've got very strong ethics, and we've got a lot of wisdom and some great ways of actually doing something for our country and our community, our world. So it's great to sit down and meditate, but not all the time. Please be involved in the community, involved in the politics, involved in whatever's going on. You live in this world, you're part of it. And you don't think it's somebody else's problem. Whose problem is it? It's not the government's problem. We put them in there. It is our problem. It's not big business's problem. It's our problem. When we always think it's our problem, then we realize we do have responsibility. So we have to be assertive. We don't just roll over and let it happen. We are assertive and do whatever it is we can do to make for a better world, to make for a better Buddhist center, to make for a better family, to make for a better human being. So it's the same, I'm assertive. If I see I've got some little idiosyncrasy, which, you know, is not really good, if my jokes are getting sort of stale and old, I try to do something about it. I'm assertive. I try and get a new book and try and read a new joke or something. So it's not just the old ones you've heard before. I'm trying to think, I did hear one a few days ago and I meant to say it, but it's got out of my mind. It's just tiredness. So anyway, assertiveness is a good thing to do. And when you are assertive, when you are contributing to the betterment of your life, betterment of your relationship, betterment of your family, of your community, of your country, of course, then you get your self-esteem. You feel good about yourself. When you just let go when it's not the right time to let go, when you just take it and take it and take it, not only are you contributing to the problem by just not being assertive, but after a while you do feel like dirt. You just do feel like hopeless and useless and not good enough. You get depressed, lose your self-esteem. And that's when you really also lose all your money as well, because you have to go to counselors and they cost a lot of money. It's much cheaper to come to the Buddhist Society earlier, where it doesn't cost anything at all. And you can save a lot of money with psychologists later on. And I know there's many psychologists here. They won't worry about me saying such things because they're all overworked anyway. I think they're very grateful that I take some of the burden away from them. But anyway, the reason is that if you actually just are assertive and actually do something about the problems in life, you actually feel you're contributing, you're part of the solution, so you actually feel good about what you did. Because I felt good about all those things which I did. I feel I've done something, I've actually helped, I've solved problems, I've made life easier for people, even just giving a bit more confidence to the gay and lesbian community, made Kingsbury Drive a safer road, you know, opened up the door a little bit wider for women to actually to join the monastic life. And those sorts of things, when I think about it, I think, wow, that's really good. That gives me a lot of self-esteem. It gives me a lot of energy, and I feel good about myself, and that makes me happy, makes my meditation deeper. You can understand how it works. Many, many people, if you feel really down and depressed, I give this advice to many people. I think I gave it last week, that if you are really depressed and down, just don't just sit there and just take it, just like you're being bullied by your depression. Like, be assertive. Go and do something about it. And one of the great things to do about it is volunteer for some community work. For example, you know, we're having an AGM tomorrow. Volunteer to serve on the committee. Volunteer just to man the desk, help in the library, do some gardening or whatever. If you don't like this place, an old people's home, sell some clothes for St. Vinny's, DePaul's or something. Volunteer. Because it's amazing just when you actually contribute to society, when you're assertive enough, not just to take the problems, but actually to do something about them, you find actually you get much, much more self-esteem. You feel really good about yourself. For 2 years when I was at university in Cambridge, I volunteered every Thursday or Wednesday afternoon, one afternoon a week, to go to the local hospital which was looking after mentally disabled people. And I volunteered every afternoon in the OT ward for Down syndrome kids. You know, the only reason I did that was out of pride. Because I had a friend who was a Christian and I was a Buddhist. We would argue, you know, like young people would do, you know, the deep and meaningfuls over a cup of coffee. Not just one cup of coffee, went on to the middle of the night, sometimes early in the morning, you know, arguing about the merits of Christianity and Buddhism. And so, you know, it was like friendly, but, you know, it's also quite competitive. And when he told me he was volunteering to do some charity work at this hospital, I thought, my goodness, I better go as well, otherwise he wins. So I'm being honest, that's why I volunteered. But once I started going there, I went there for 2 years. And, you know, these Christians, they gave up after 2 or 3 weeks. But, you know, I was actually there for a long time. But it wasn't that, you know, I was doing this to feel to do good. After 2 or 3 weeks, it wasn't charity anymore. I enjoyed going over there. I looked forward to it. I had such a wonderful time over there. I learned so much over there. And I'd say to this day, what I learned from those Down syndrome kids was just emotional language. Because they just couldn't speak sort of good English. So they communicated with me just with the hug or with the snarl or whatever it was. So you could tell exactly how they felt. And what was surprising, as many of you might know if you've ever had any dealings with mentally disabled people, they suss you out straight away. If I came that afternoon and I was in a bad mood, they would know, much more than any other person would know. They were so sensitive to the emotions. So that's what they taught me, just how to contact a person with emotions, how to know where they were at, and to know where I was at as well. So they taught me emotional language. And if I'm a good teacher now, I think that's one of the reasons you got that emotional facility. And that's, I think, why I learned it. And that was just because I was giving, I thought. But I got too much. I got so much back in return. And that's what happens. So don't just sit there and do nothing. Just go out and serve. And your self-esteem goes up. Or just stand up for, you know, for what's right. You feel so good afterwards. You know, hiss a little bit, and your self-esteem goes up. But of course, remember, you're not hissing for yourself. It's always about us. Because if it's for yourself, you're just making a division in your relationship. Don't hiss at your partner, you know, because it's about me. Because it's about us. And when it's us, you don't break up, you know, with the hiss, with the assertiveness, the beautiful relationship. Now, you're not thinking of yourself. You're not thinking of the other. You're thinking of us. It's the interconnectedness, the jointness. We're together, we're in this as a partnership. When you do that, you can be assertive, and that assertiveness is part of our life. Don't take it to the point of being aggressive, because there are sometimes you're assertive and it doesn't work. You fail, the boss is just as bad as normal. Or you're assertive to your partner and he's not changing. When those things happen, if you take an assertiveness, you know, as far as you can, don't take it to the next step and be violent. Because a lot of times that people, they use assertiveness as a means of solving a problem, and they make the difference, they make the mistake of like using it as a means of control. Because when you control, you expect outcomes. Not so much you expect outcomes, but you demand outcomes. Then eventually you just get frustrated. You know what it's like, you're frustrated. I've done all this and it's not working. And you can see the next thing that I just already banged my knees. It's anger coming out. And with that anger, violence. It's unrealistic expectations or demands leads to frustration, which leads to anger, which leads to violence. But you know what the next stage is after violence? It's depression. The reason why you get depressed is because after a while nothing works, so you just give up. And also anger and violence take a huge amount of energy. You know when you get angry or you get violent, you really feel alive. You feel so strong. But where's that energy coming from? You're borrowing that energy. And after that anger or that sort of passion disappears, you've got to pay for that energy. You've used it all up, right? You know, you spent all the money, you know, from your salary, and there's nothing left to buy food for the rest of the week. That's called depression. The mind being hungry for energy. So this is one of the great causes. So please don't go down that path. Be assertive, but don't take it as far as anger. And you realize that sometimes this is our world. Sometimes this is what bosses are like. I know that one of the jokes I read said, if you ever think your boss is stupid, be grateful. If he was wise, he wouldn't have employed you. That's one of those sort of self-deprecatory sort of jokes. But anyway, that you know, sometimes this is what it's like. If you really have a great time at work and you really enjoy yourself there, then they wouldn't need to pay you. I always say your salary is a bribe. It's a bribe for making you get up on a Monday morning and go to work. You know, would you really want to do that? So remember this, you know, part of going to work will be unpleasant. That's part of the course. Having a relationship, there will be some part which is unpleasant. You know, and yeah, you may be assertive to try and change things, which is good, but remember you can't change that much. And sometimes you just have to learn to be equanimous and be patient and just let things be. This is our world. Yeah, we try and move it along a little bit. And that's all I try and do, to move it on along a little bit, make it a better world, and let somebody else take up that burden afterwards and make it even more better and more better. And each one of us doing a little bit. But we don't demand such great success. If I demanded total success with what I did, then I'd have got so depressed many, many years ago. You know, you teach, and still you guys keep coming back every Friday evening. Haven't you got it yet? So you've been coming here for the last 26 years and still come back. So, you know, you should understand the whole idea of a teacher. A teacher is not someone who wants to get more disciples. A teacher is someone who wants to get rid of disciples. You know, like a teacher in a school. If I was teaching grade 6, and grade 6 kept coming back year after year after year after year after year after year for 26 years, I'd have been given another job a long time ago. So the job of a teacher is trying to get rid of disciples, trying to sort of get them wise. So that's actually the whole idea there. So be assertive. Even more so, be assertive to yourself as well. Don't just sit there and be stupid. Just be assertive. Hiss sometimes. If you're doing something wrong, hiss at it. Say, no, that's a wrong thing to do. Don't do that. It's called restraint. But don't get angry at yourself. No, I'm hopeless. Look at me. I did a wrong thing. Why did I do that? I'm really stupid. I gave a wrong talk. I gave the wrong advice. I'm a hopeless monk. I'm terrible. Maybe I should just go in a little hut in a cave and never come out again. So you don't just take it and bully yourself. Be assertive. Hiss at yourself, but in the right way. And how should you hiss at yourself in the right way? Sandwich method. Ajahn Brahm, you're a really good monk. Ajahn Brahm, I really work hard. You know, I just give so many hours to people, and I sit there and try and talk to people. But, you know, your jokes are really bad. Okay, I accept that. But you're a nice, kind monk and a very good person. And so even me, when I sort of, you know, advise and admonish myself, I use sandwich method as well. So when you actually look at yourself and you feel guilty about something, you've done something wrong, admonish yourself, but with the sandwich method. Yeah, you know, I won't go into that because I've been going too far. But anyway, that is the way to be assertive. And of course, when you're assertive that way, you actually grow in life. You become a better person. That's a spiritual path. You know, you see your faults, be honest to it, but couch them in the good qualities which you have. Admonish yourself, hiss, but don't get angry. Don't bite yourself and get sort of upset at yourself and angry at all the terrible bad things you did. Acknowledge them, but couch them in praise and do sandwich method to yourself as well. And that way you can be assertive in life. You don't just allow sort of the bad people in life just to abuse you and to control you, and you don't. And you stand up for what's right in the correct way, with sandwich method, with compassion, thinking it's not just about me, it's about us. Sometimes I do that to myself, because it's not just about me. Because whatever I do, I share with you. You know, what you do, you share with me. So we're in it together. If I have a good meditation, you share it, because you get some nice teachings afterwards. So all the stuff which I do, that's what I share with you every Friday and every time I talk with you. So we all share things. So when I sort of look at myself and I want to sort of try and make myself a better monk, it's not just for me, it's for us. And for me, that's just the story of life. Even when I'm meditating alone in my cave, it's not just about me, it's about us. You can't get away from that. So no one here is alone. You're all part of this thing which we call life. It's always about us, always was, always will be. So be kind to yourself, admonish yourself, sandwich method, with a hiss, but not with anger. Don't bite yourself. And that way there can be growth for you, and there can be growth in our communities. And never again do you think a Buddhist has to just be a doormat. You can actually be kind, but you don't need to be angry. You don't need to be, if I make a mistake, you don't have to throw rotten tomatoes at me. Actually, that's why, you know why in Buddhist temples, why you take your shoes off before you come into the Buddhist temples? That's because you can't throw them at me when I tell a bad joke. They do that these days. That's the most common thing to throw at people, when they, ever since they threw that sandal at Mr. Bush. And didn't they do that they did that in one of the elections, didn't they, in Australia? Was it Kevin Rudd or something? Anyway, it's become like worldwide custom. If you don't like someone, you throw your shoes at them. So Buddhists, we're so terrified of that happening. You keep all your shoes outside, okay? Okay, well, there we go. I managed to get through the hour. So I'm getting a bit tired because I'm traveling too much, doing too much. But nevertheless, I hope you enjoyed that talk, and I hope you got something out of it. And hopefully that you did understand, the story of the snake. Hiss sometimes, but don't bite. Thank you for listening. Okay, anybody got any feedback? Criticism? But if you do give me criticism, praise me first and then criticize. Yes. Okay, there's asking, somebody was questioning, India, is it holding itself back because it's more into the philosophy rather than the action? And it's a huge population in India, and it's similar to China. China is developing very fast, but India is developing, but maybe not as fast. And is their philosophy holding them back? And look, you know, development is great, but how are you developing? And it's nice if you have the development with kindness and compassion to people, because sometimes in China, some of these, you know, stories and which you've read there about people being driven from their homes because of development, and sometimes poor people having a huge degree of sort of problems there. So sometimes development at all costs is a terrible thing. So we need to have development, but balanced, sustainable, and all those other sensitive things we should do with development. And I think, so I'm not sure about India. I haven't been there for a while now. But a lot of people look back upon such places as, or look even now to places like Bhutan, with its gross national happiness instead of gross national product idea of development, which again is a very beautiful way of looking at life, developing it, keeping your philosophy, but being active as well, doing something about it, but with kindness, with compassion, with sensitivity. So I'm not sure if it is holding it back. It's interesting to see what happens. What's holding Australia back? Wouldn't it be lovely if we had a development model which actually took everybody into account, where the no profit was not the major motivator for developments, but for the betterment of society and for the more happiness, health, prosperity of our people, not just profits? You know, you can't measure sort of success or happiness in money. If it was, I'd be the most miserable person in Australia, because I'm way down there with the least wealthy. I just, you know, saw in the newspaper today, just think Facebook has got this list of the richest people in the world. And why don't they have the list of the poorest people in the world? Because then I might come top. The poorest people in this world, number one, you know, Ajahn Brahm, Venerable Chunda, you know, Ajahn Wayama, the 10 most poor people in the world. So we should have that Forbes poor list. So, but again, what you're showing there, just being wealthy doesn't mean happiness. And being poor means you can be blissed out. So then development, what should it be? So that's one thing we can do. So I think the thought of India is a huge, rich philosophy of life. I think it should be exploited, used in their development model. Have an alternative and see which one works.